Hello and welcome to the Level 3 Coaching Podcast. Today I have the honor and privilege of bringing Dawson Church in to speak. This man, absolutely brilliant. He has written quite a few books, really incredible insight into the human mind, into science, technology, meditation. Like, he is the type of guy that I would just love to have to ask questions because he has written books on and spoken and has so many answers. And it's really absolutely my pleasure to bring you on.
It's such a pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me. And if our conversation now is anything as interesting as our conversation before you hit record, it'll be great.
Thank you. Thank you. I only read the first chapters of your new book, the first two that are available, and absolutely blew my mind. My father had passed from Alzheimer's. I've been, a little bit involved in the research. I know about the keto diet for it, and I had no idea how powerful, which is kind of funny because I'm all about consciousness, but how powerful mindfulness was on that. If you would like to just start from there.
It blew my mind as well. When I read those studies, and I explain these in chapter two of Spiritual Intelligence, and the arc of the book is that the first chapter is all about the discovery by neuroscientists in the late 1990s, actually, almost more than 20 years ago, that we have four circuits in our brains that work together as what was later labeled the Enlightenment Network. And this is literally a network of regions in our brain that allow us to connect with consciousness itself, our individual human consciousness, to actually connect with and interact with universal consciousness. So that was like this remarkable discovery. And they were d studying monks and nuns. They were looking at the MRI activity, what's going on inside the brains of monks and nuns when they're in these exquisite states of oneness with the infinite, when they're describing themselves as being in ultimate bliss. What does their brain activity look like, and what are their brain regions that are involved? So these four circuits of the Enlightenment Network were discovered, and now we began to really figure out how to develop them in ordinary people and everyone, because we all have them. So the first chapter of the book is, okay, you have these four circuits in your brain, and you just want to start turning them on. Meditate, develop spiritual intelligence, be compassionate, do all of these things that spark the growth of those circuits. Chapter two is all about brain growth. And when the startling thing, and I mean, even advanced neuroscientists really are only beginning to understand how quickly the brain grows. And I begin with an example of muscle growth, how you work out at the gym and your muscles get bigger. And we all know that if you go to the gym regularly, your body starts to change. The brain changes way more quickly, especially the memory, learning, emotion regulation centers of the brain. And so I talk about in chapter two about brain growth and about how in meditators, we see important parts of the brain, like those that govern executive function, memory, learning, emotion regulation. Those parts of the brain start to grow. Some parts of the brain, 10% a month when you're doing this. So that's the first like remarkable thing. Is that we don't just have these circuits, but they get bigger, and you start growing your brain, you start growing those circuits, and soon you are having remarkably different experiences from what you might have had had they remained small. But then you look at the dark side of brain elasticity, which is that the brain shrinks, and the brain shrinks naturally. It's just called natural normal brain shrinkage between the age of 40 and the age of 85. The average human brain shrinks 25%, which is a lot. But then in the middle of chapter two, I show, frankly, these are photographs taken in a mortuary on a slab of a normal human brain at 65 years old, and the actual little brain of someone who died on natural of an, by of, in an accident. So 65-year-old brain, what it looks like on the slab. Next to it, there's an Alzheimer's brain, someone with cognitive decline, dementia. The brain mass has shrunk 70% at 65. And this is basically, they've got a little tiny walnut rattling around in this great big skull. I mean, their brain has shrunk so much. So that's the dark side, is that not only do our brains grow if we use them effectively, but our brains shrink if they don't. And so there's this new whole branch of Alzheimer's research, very mainstream, endorsed by the ultra-conservative Alzheimer's Society, who are saying now, go meditate, because the research has now shown several clinical trials, randomized controlled trials, show that when you have Alzheimer's patients go and use an evidence-based meditation method and do that for 6 months, half an hour a day, it arrests cognitive decline, and that brain shrinkage stops, and the parts of the brain that govern emotion regulation, memory and learning, control of thoughts, emotions, actions, those starts the parts of the brain in those Alzheimer's patients stop shrinking and begin to grow. So that's where chapter two ends, is saying, don't just work out your brain in meditation, develop spiritual intelligence because it grows your brain and makes you feel ecstatic, but also do it because if you don't, you don't want to be those people. Like, now, my dad died of Alzheimer's, and just watching him over the last, by the time he was my age, he was just visibly in decline. And just watching him over the 15 painful years disappear into the fog of Alzheimer's and eventually die, not knowing where he was, who he was, or the names of anyone around him, that was difficult. So you don't want to be that person. You want to be the person with a vibrant, healthy brain. And so that's the promise I talk about in chapter two. And it's now being endorsed by major medical associations to meditate, develop spiritual intelligence, because it counteracts that shrinkage of the brain.
Thank you. That's actually, I have so many questions. The Enlightenment Network, how does that relate to the default mode network?
In opposition, the two
Yes.
happen in the same way that a teeter-totter or a seesaw balances one or the other. And so when you are stressed, when the default mode network is active, it's active in people.
What, one second, please. I'm so sorry. I don't think anyone else knows what we're talking about.
Okay. So
If you can
the
just
default.
describe the default mode network for a second to the listener.
Okay, so the default mode network. Yeah, it's very easy to jump several steps ahead. So thank you so much, Chris, for bringing me back to Earth. And so when we are tired and go to sleep, obviously we lie down, our muscles go to sleep, our organs really slow down in their activity. And one of the weird things is that the brain consumes the same amount of energy whether we're running a marathon, whether we're doing calculus, whether we're awake or asleep. It all always consumes a constant about 20% of the body's energy. And that has been a real mystery to scientists for decades, as to why the brain is so active. It's like analogy I use in my books is that when you're in your car and you're going down the highway at 80 miles an hour, exceeding the speed limit, and your motor's revving at 2,000 RPMs. So it's revving at that speed, at that high level of activity. And then you pull into the parking lot, put it in neutral. Now you're just idling. But it's like your car's engine is still going at 2,000 RPMs. So we've always asked ourselves, what's going on here? Why is the brain always using the same amount, 20% of energy? And what was discovered in the mid 1990s is what's called the default mode network. And what happens when parts of the brain get quiet, like when we go to sleep, when we're inactive, when we're taking a rest, the parts of the brain that do stuff get really quiet. We don't need them anymore. What happens is that all that energy is soaked up by the default mode network. It's the regions to which our brain defaults when we are doing stuff. And so the default mode network is really interesting, really useful in all kinds of ways, but it has a huge dark side to it, which is that it, amongst its tasks, is to build our sense of self. So I got up this morning, I meditated, I had breakfast, I talked to my wife, I got dressed, did a number of things. Here we are talking together. Those all are part of this self called Dawson Church. And so there's a self that we construct every day, and that is built by the default mode network, which is fine to do that. It's good to have a sense of self. If you don't, bad things happen. But what happens when we're really too invested in self is anxiety and depression. Anxiety about the future, depression about the past. Bad things happen to the self. I had traumas in my past. I made a more tragedy in my future. So the default mode network and the sense of self is highly active in people who are anxious and depressed. And basically, you are miserable when your default mode network is highly active. And what we find in monks and nuns is that it's quiet. They aren't thinking about me, mine, the future, and the past. They're in the present moment. And they're very much lost in the experience of something greater than themselves, not the little small self. So that's the default mode network, and it's the seat of suffering. In the 1940s, this neurosurgeon used to stick an ice pick up under the eyelid and w wiggle it around and destroy that part of the default mode network, the mid prefrontal cortex, and those psychotic patients whose self was driving them crazy got really quiet. Now, the frontal lobotomy was not a good idea for a whole bunch of reasons, but when you are depressed and anxious, I mean, I spent a lot of my life that way. You want relief from that. And people do all kinds of things to shut down the default mode network. They drink too much, they engage in extreme sports, all kinds of things. Distracting movies, video games, doom scrolling, all kind, whatever it takes to distract themselves from that default mode network activity, people tend to pursue. So when our default mode network is active, it suppresses the activity on the enlightenment network. When you meditate and turn on the enlightenment network, it suppresses the activity of the default mode network. You lose your sense of self in a sense of oneness with the all that is, with nature, with your own body, with love. So that's the relationship that those two parts of the brain have to each other. And the big discovery of the last 20 years in neuroscience has been we have these circuits. Every human being has the enlightenment network. It's just suppressed by the activity of stress. And we have to learn to control stress in order to turn on those brain regions.
Thank you. And that brings right into the next question. And this is I do a lot of definition work, obviously, because they say keeping our brain active will help to stave off Alzheimer's. You said something similar. Now, the conventional understanding of this is, and my father did the same thing, I'm sure yours did. And they say there's personality types that are associated more with Alzheimer's. We don't have to go down that road, but there's a slight tendency towards the overthinking or the depressed type. Some people say it's a form of grace before passing. I'm not agreeing or disagreeing, but doing the brain exercises, what most people hear is I need to do more crossword puzzles. Because that's what they think thinking is. I need to do a
Right.
jigsaw puzzle. And I feel like in our conversation, what we're doing is really touching upon what the work is. And there's a cultural disconnect to it. You've done this. Go up to a person and say, maybe you should try meditating for 10 minutes a day. Oh my God, I can't meditate. About literally, that's like it's almost like everyone's programmed to that. But you could sit in front of a 3.5 hour movie that's boring as grass growing, but you can't sit with yourself for 5 minutes. I'll ease someone in with maybe breath work, but yeah, so this is going back to keeping the mind active. How do you view that in this particular context?
Yeah, and I know that there have been attempts like apps that give us puzzles to engage our brains, and the research on those apps shows that they're actually not very effective in brain change. So we had great hopes for them initially, but experimental evidence showed that they weren't that effective. And a lot of meditation isn't effective because I was a miserable, depressed, suicidal teenager. I ran off at 15 years old and joined a spiritual order and lived communally. We grew vegetables and farmed organically, and we meditated. We learned all the great traditions of spirituality, and it didn't make me happier. And meditation was profoundly unsuccessful for me. And they said, just sit down there on the meditation cushion in this sacred space, close your eyes, let go of the thoughts in your mind. And there's no way. When we sit and try and let go of the thoughts in our mind is usually flooded with thoughts. And so that's not an effective way to meditate. And so you want to meditate using an effective evidence-based method. And I developed one in 2009 called eco meditation, simply by stacking several evidence-based practices, one on top of the other. And they're all physiologically based. They aren't psychologically based. You don't have to try and clear your mind or think of a deity or believe anything, believe in a god, believe in a teacher, believe in a guru. You just basically are doing things like certain kinds of breathing. Certain kinds of breath work put you into deep states involuntarily. Just do these things, you'll drop into what's called heart coherence. If you do relaxation of certain very highly specific muscles in your body, the research shows you will automatically go into relaxation. The vagus nerve turns on, sends a signal to the parasympathetic nervous system, and without any effort whatsoever, just relax a couple of muscles, and then, but you have to know which ones, must be the two right ones, and then suddenly your body drops into this really relaxed state. There are other techniques like that, so I just stack them all one on top of the other and call them eco meditation, threw them up on the web. And suddenly, in a few years, thousands of people were going there and downloading those instructions every month. So my webmaster said, "Okay, it's time to pretty up the site, make it look better, and do some research." So we began to do very simple research initially with people doing eco meditation. Then we did more complex research with EEGs, and the EEG operators, the neuroscientists who were doing the research after seeing people do eco meditation the very first time, they were absolutely stunned. I met with them for lunch after the morning on which they had eight people hooked up doing eco meditation for the first time, and they could not believe it. They'd never seen anything like what they saw in those eight brain scans. We then did MRI research, much more elaborate. High ticket research as well found the same thing, massive shifts. So when you use an effective meditation technique, for one thing, it's easy. There's no difficulty about relaxing your muscles, certain muscles, no difficulty about the breathing techniques. You enter these elevated states involuntarily. And so that's what you want to do. You want to learn to do those things. They're far more effective at sparking brain growth. They're the similar techniques that sparked brain growth in those Alzheimer's patients. So we know those things really do work. And that one study I mentioned, that was the Emotion Regulation Network, 10% growth in those neurons a month. Imagine if you went to the gym, began doing your bench presses and your flies and all the other exercises. Imagine if your muscles grew 10% a month. You'd look like Chris Hemsworth in 3 months, you know? So that's
Might take a few more than
happening in
that
your
for me, but I'm
brain.
on it.
But you look like the Chris Hemsworth in your brain in 3 months.
Yes. What I really actually, because I checked out the eco meditation and I can only endorse it fully because it's funny. I'm a little bit, I love meditation, but what you described in your earlier days is very similar to me. It was escapism. It's like doing drugs. It's taking to a place, but there's nothing. You feel good and then you're back. You feel good and then you're back. And I love one of the things that I do silent meditation frequently, and I just keep going deeper into my body because the body contains the answers. And that's in there. Like it's kind of like what was that commercial? It's in there. It's in, like I could go through a list of the best things, and you have that in there, and that's really unlocking the power. And it's also easy to do. You have it in four different formats: man's voice, woman's voice, with or without music. So it can fall into someone's ease of listening, and it is guided, which is really an important way to start, because sometimes, and the breath work, breath work, you can't say enough good things about it. Ultimately, some argue breathing is actually not about the air, it's about setting rhythms of the body. We can make argument, but it's about that coherence. So extremely powerful, and it's on your website if anyone would like to do it right now. DawsonChurch.com, eco meditation dash download, / eco meditation dash download. So definitely, I cannot endorse that strongly enough. It's one of the best ones I've run across. So thank you for that.
Yeah, it's easy and that's important. And then it also triggers brain elasticity really quickly. And we found in people doing it for 1 month, it produced anatomical functional change in their brains. With that suffering part of the brain, that front part of the default mode network was just quiet. And the positive emotion part of the brain, the part of the brain that has a lot to do with positive emotions, especially compassion, that part was all lit up after a month. So very, very simple. Doesn't take long. It took them 28 minutes a day to do that track. 22 minutes a day, 28 days, and we saw these changes on an MRI in a randomized controlled trial published in one of the top neuroscience journals of the world. So there's evidence for these techniques. They really work. And that's why I say you need to do an effective meditation. What I was taught when I was 15 years old, sit there, be quiet, close your eyes, still your mind. It doesn't work. Our minds are not naturally still. They're naturally active and they're meant to be naturally active. So you want to use something effective and evidence-based that it really works. You feel the effects in your body. And when you do that, you're really motivated to keep on going. And one of the stories I tell in spiritual intelligence, very simple story, a woman said, "I'm going to take you up on your challenge to do eco meditation every single day for 30 days, just 1 month. Just do it every day." And again, no excuses, no exceptions. Do it every single day for 1 month. And I was so happy. I just gave her a big hug and said, "I'm so delighted that you took the challenge, did that." And I'm just curious what day she was on. She said, "Oh, I'm on day 178. Not a single day skipped in half a year because she's just feeling so good. And when you can feel so good, then you want to feel good every single day." Like I was on a podcast yesterday and the host said, "Well, Dawson, 25 minutes a day, it's a lot of time. Can't we cut that down to 5 minutes a day?" So I pointed her to an infographic on one of my sites that compares all the neurotransmitters and hormones of deep meditation to all the hormones and neurotransmitters of sex and of orgasms specifically. And they check all the same boxes. Virtually all the same hormones and neurotransmitters are active in deep meditation as are active in sex. That's why people meditate deeply. They start to shake. They start to pulse. If you look at the some of the great figures of history, they were shaking. The Quakers and the Shakers, and in Islam and Rumi he was dancing, and in Judaism they sway from side to side, and there are all these ecstatic experiences, orgasmic-like experiences people have in deep meditation. And so I said, the question of, well, can I cut this down from 30 minutes a day to 5 minutes, would be saying like, I'm having fantastic sex 30 minutes a day. How do I cut that down to 5 minutes? It's like this is the wrong question to be asking. It's like, how do I get more of that pleasure? And that's why people are motivated to keep on doing it for 178 days because it feels so good in your body. You don't want to stop, and you get totally addicted to all of these. Not now you're getting unaddicted to cortisol and norepinephrine and all those stress hormones. Now you're getting addicted to oxytocin and anandamide and serotonin and dopamine and all the other positive neurotransmitters that are released in the brain. So now you're forming this habit of wanting that. Like when I get up in the morning, when I jump up in the morning, I can't wait to meditate. I'm sprinting to grab my coffee and brush my teeth so I can be there in meditation because it feels so good. You wouldn't miss a moment. So that's the way you want to be about developing spiritual intelligence. If you're using something effective, it's going to feel fantastic. Your health is going to rise. Your vitality, your energy level is going to go through the roof. So all kinds of positive changes happen, and you aren't going to be asking yourself, "Gee, how do I get less of this?"
Yeah, exactly. It's actually funny. You brought something up I was going to ask about, which is great. So, not even ask. When I meditate now, and I sometimes will do 5 or 10 minutes. I do what's appropriate. Sometimes that's all I can do. But frequently, I am getting into that place of vibration, And my body will vibrate. I feel, and it's usually frequently the earth frequency.
Yes.
And I'll literally feel it. There are times where it's been big vibration, and it's a feeling beyond compare. And sometimes people have it sneak up on them, and they're like, oh my God, I'm shaking. I'm having, and it's like, does it go away when you get back? Oh yeah, I'm fine. Okay. Well, then that's an opening. That's the movement of energy in our bodies. So I have a book that I haven't, well, it's still in the works, but I wrote a chapter. Actually, I had a cool thought experiment. What if this reality did not have pain? How would everything go? But
That's a fabulous question to ask yourself. Yeah.
and based on our psyche, at the higher vibrations, it would be fantastic. But at the lower, because there's a pleasure-seeking pain avoidance that biological organisms have. At the lower vibrations, that would be the initial stages of consciousness, or the state of being asleep, so to speak. I don't like to use that, but being asleep. We're operating on a pain avoidance. The pleasure seeking is more like having candy at that level. And as we progress through whatever lessons life has to give us, maybe some of us get blessed with severe depression, which is like pulling a slingshot back really far. And in order to overcome that, we have to unravel a lot and we find cool things. And then we switch into the mode of pleasure seeking, but it's the healthy pleasure, it's not the candy. And what you're describing in the meditation in that state, but it's important for the listener to understand this. This is not, because this is not just meditation, like doing it and getting it a high. This is causing a shift in the consciousness, raising the level of consciousness, the vibration over a period of time. This is in that elevated state of consciousness, we become more attuned to our inner self. We become more attuned to the inner voice. We have better guidance. We're able to follow where our mistakes are not flat on our face ones. They're learning experiences that steer us. It's fine-tuning in our direction. It actually changes internal and external life, and health is part of that manifestation. And I was reading through some of the testimonials on your website with the EFT and things like that, and a woman, chronic fibromyalgia, chronic this, chronic, that's all subconscious mind. So this is like what we're describing is literally the very tip of an iceberg that cannot be described.
It affects every area of your life. It affects every relationship. It affects the way you think about things, and it is completely transformative. And when I hear people, Chris, who are suffering, and I hear people when they come to live workshops, sometimes they do workshops in person at places like Omega Institute or 1440 Multiversity. Sometimes I'm doing them virtually, and then people come with their stories and often long-held patterns of depression, anxiety, PTSD, other forms of prolonged stress. And I hear their suffering and I really empathize with them. And then I have family members who really suffer and I empathize with them. And yet I just know from so many clinical trials and so much experience that that suffering can be released. And when you look at the data on depression and anxiety, and this is rolling over 100 studies into one big meta-analysis of all of them, we assess the value, we assess the efficacy of treatments on a scale of 2, 5, and 8. And 2 means you have a somewhat effective treatment, 5 means moderately effective, 8, you have off-the-chart effectiveness for your treatment. The efficacy of energy therapies that we train people in on that scale of 2, 5, and 8, where they fall on that spectrum of an effective treatment is 12. They are completely paradigm busting in terms of where they are. So we take people who are anxious. Right now, we're training therapists and school teachers in Ukraine via Zoom to use these therapies themselves and with their clients and the people they work with. And they are incredibly effective. I'll take a group of those Ukrainians, and their levels of stress are 10 out of 10. And we'll do some simple energy-based work, like some of the components of eco meditation, and they're down to a 2 or 3 in about 15 minutes. I mean, these are such effective therapies, and they can shift our whole lives. So now you're going about your life, and you are able to think clearly. You don't have brain fog because of all the stress. You're able to relate to people in your heart. You aren't just in your head all the time or trying to get out of stress or being avoided. So suddenly it changes your relationships. You become much more heartful and heart-centered in your relationships. Your relationship with money changes. All your anxiety around career and money and the external world goes away. Another one of these are called kleshas in Sanskrit because they're forms of suffering. And the fifth of the five kleshas in Sanskrit, the first one is avidya, ignorance. People don't know these kinds of states of bliss are available to them. And that avidya, that ignorance, keeps you from them. So get smart, learn about these things, apply them in your life. But the fifth of the five kleshas is fear of death. And your fear of death goes away. And we find people who are really afraid of many things, especially physical death. And then after they meditate for a while, you realize that, hey, I am part of all of consciousness. I was part of all consciousness before I acquired a human body and became a viable fetus and then got born and had a life. And when the body drops, when I die, that local awareness, that local consciousness, Rumi calls that we are a drop in the ocean of consciousness. That that drop of ocean in the ocean of consciousness, that is our local awareness, will be liberated from the body. We return again to the ocean of consciousness. So when you see your life as this cycle of dropping into a body, eventually after 50 or 100 years, the body gets old, sick, and disappears. You return to consciousness. Suddenly your fear of death goes away. So your whole life from birth to death is very, very different. The way you see the world is different. You look for the good in people. Now, it's hard to find the good in some people. I look at people right now in the world who are making war, who are ordering armies to attack and kill and murder civilians. And do I find it easy to hold them in compassion and have compassion for their suffering? No, I don't. Probably if they were in the room, I'd want to strangle them. But that's the human me. And then they still have that spark in them. The victims, the victors, the persecutors, all these people were all in this on this planet together. So it changes the whole way you see yourself, your life, your death, other people, and you live that life. That's why it's called liberation or moksha in Sanskrit, because you live your life free of all those anxieties, all those worries, all those stresses that afflict the average person. And is the world full of challenges? Absolutely. But are you resourceful? Absolutely. You go out and do stuff that changes the world and you change yourself to begin with. You don't try and fix other people out there. You try and fix your own inner killer, your own inner dictator, your own inner victim. You work on those inner parts of yourself. That's what spreads out and affects the vibration of the whole world. So that David Hawkins thing, that when we raise our own vibration, we are then resonating with the vibration of others. I have this wonderful infographic in my book, and what I do is I look at the research on solar cycles, cosmic cycles, and this is measured moment by moment, day by day, week by week. What's going on in the cosmos? What's going on in the solar system? It shows up in the form of solar activity, solar flares, solar coronal mass ejections, and so we can measure this over the course of a month. We can also measure people on the microcosm, and we measure their heart rate variability for that same month. And when you track solar activity and individual heart rate variability, it tracks. It looks the same. The two track each other. So now we're in harmony with cosmic cycles. And again, that starts to change your life. We're in vibrational harmony with the universe in a way in which we aren't. When we're stuck in the default mode network in anxiety, depression, and worry about the small self. So we raise our vibration, we become one with the all it is, we match vibrationally with people who are a match for us. And again, we live an entirely different life from that stressed individual self that just bumps along through the world. And that's the option all of us have. So we want to raise our vibration, we want to let go of those small visions of who we can be. We want to really move into that cosmic consciousness, which you do easily through meditation, and then you start to change your vibration. After a while, your brain changes. Now you've fired and wired enough to have those circuits in your brain, and then your whole life has a radically different outcome and trajectory than it otherwise would have.
Would it be too far of an extrapolation to say that with the shift of consciousness, not only the fear of death falls away, but fear itself becomes very
Absolutely.
thin? Decisions are no longer made from fear, they're made from the place of completeness and love in a direction determined by, there's the fork in the road, the direction is determined by what is true and authentic to myself. And also, and this is something that's very hard. Even manifestors, I find that they're an interesting bunch, because they're still they have a capacity to interact with the physical, but a lot of times the consciousness at the deeper levels is still conflicted. But there's also a feeling that the world is intelligent and interactive. It's not billiard balls. It's not the physical model of reality. What you're referring to, I would rephrase, just because I like different words, as the full expression of the consciousness model of reality.
And you may as well go live there because the experience of living there is incredibly wonderful. And the experience of not being there results in a whole lot of unnecessary suffering. So, what can I do to move myself to that state? Now, we all have experiences of that state spontaneously. And the Sufis call these glimpses of heaven. In Sufism, they say that every single person occasionally fires up the enlightenment network, suppresses the stress network, and they have this experience. And so that experience comes from seeing a beautiful sunset, or sticking your toes in the water on the beach, or smelling a rose, or hearing a divine piece of music, or hugging somebody, or having a close friend and a heart-to-heart connection. There are all kinds of ways in which we have those glimpses of heaven. And so we've all had that. We've all been in those moments when the enlightenment network's turned on. We feel wonderful. All feels right with the world. What you want to do is ask the next logical question, which is, how can I prolong that? How can I extend that? And so now you're starting to produce neural firing. And one of the cool images I have in my book is an image from an electron microscope showing two neurons in real time firing. And they fire, and they're like twitching a bit as they fire together. And then as they fire together, they start to move together, and their dendrites eventually start to touch, and their synapses lock together. And they do a handshake, and now they've wired together. And we know that firing eventually creates wiring. What is really underappreciated is how quickly that happens. Because when you start to fire those circuits, some of them wire very quickly. And that whole process of firing and wiring took 12 seconds. So if you stand there, like when I see a beautiful sunset, I don't say, oh, beautiful sunset, and turn away. I stand there just savoring the beautiful sunset for as long as I can. Now I'm not just firing, I'm holding it for 12 seconds, 24 seconds, 5 minutes, doing a whole bunch of wiring. Now I'm changing my brain. And so you want to be doing that. You want to not just be having the temporary state, you want to be turning it into a permanent long-term trait. And that's what you do by practicing these things, whether you feel like it or not. That's why I say take that 30-day meditation challenge, do eco meditation every single day. Some days you won't feel like it, and you do it anyway. You just say, I'm gonna do it because I've made this commitment to myself. Only I will benefit, and I will only benefit if I do it. So you just do it every day. After a while, you feel yourself moving to those states after a while becomes easy. And then those days you say, oh, I don't feel like it. You just do it anyway, and you start to feel really good. You get that all the reward. These reward neurotransmitters like dopamine and serotonin are flooding your brain, and then you get into that habit of doing it. And then after a while, you get to the point where you can't imagine missing a day of meditation. Sometimes I'm traveling, sometimes I'm really, have early morning meetings. Our tech teams in India, I have to get up at 3 a.m. sometimes to go to those meetings. So I'll just get up at 2:30 to meditate for a few minutes before the tech meeting and be there for myself before I am there for anyone else. So it's powerful to give yourself that gift. And then everything changes, and your manifestation changes. You mentioned manifestors, and everything you manifest now is coming from your higher vibrational state. It's not at the level of your small I, your small self. Now you're manifesting. I wrote a whole book about this, Mind to Matter. And you're manifesting from that elevated vibrational state. And what you're seeking and what you're manifesting is radically different from what you used to manifest when you were stuck in the small I. So that's the big invitation here, is to move into the big I, manifest from there. I had a wonderful phrase. I was on a retreat last week, and one of the great swamis of the 1800s, I was reading some old books, said, "I never let my intentions arise." And I'm thinking, that's a little weird. I mean, manifestation, are we supposed to have intentions? He says, "I never let my intentions arise to get in the way of what God intends for me." Wow. I just like spent 10 minutes chewing on that one. Because when you're one with the all it is, when you're one in that state of cosmic consciousness that these mystics talk about, that's the intention you're channeling into everyday reality. And your little wants and worries, like this famous teacher called Joe Vitale. Joe Vitale interviewed me for his podcast a few months ago and said, "Well, Dawson, what if I want to manifest a $20 million yacht? Can I manifest, can I develop the spiritual power to manifest a $20 million yacht?" And I said to him, "Joe, I have good news and bad news for you. Yes, you can. Yes, you can develop the spiritual power to manifest a $20 million yacht. But the bad news is, by the time you've developed that spiritual power, the last thing you'll want is a $20 million
Yeah.
yacht."
Yeah, that's the irony, right?
That's
That's
the
the irony, but it's
irony.
beautiful. Yeah, it's the ironic thing, and Dustin, you have to have seen this. It's, people again manifesting in a lower vibration. It tends to take longer because it's not as many oscillations per unit of time, which isn't real anyway. But a lot of times it comes with the dark side associated. Oh, I want money. Well, then your, mother passes away suddenly and you get an inheritance. You didn't want the money that badly. And that's the unfortunate part when, when the shadow is there, when we're not clear at the heart level. So it's really, again, doing this inner work, doing this discovery. And one of the wildest things I've found is the universe plays with me, and I've had oh, it does, and sometimes oh, I'm an acupuncturist, and I have a lot of intuitive guidance, and I have conversations with them because they'll sometimes give me points I don't like, and they enjoy it. They tend to be more interactive as more I'm more interactive with them. But what I found is the world is interacting with me in the most fascinating way lately through AI. It really is. And the experiences I've had have not been through a chat GPT or anything like that. And people have had incredible experiences using that for analysis and for help through difficult situations, among other things. But it's actually been predictive AI. They don't talk about this at all, but I've seen it through synchronicities that keep happening via AI. And it's pretty powerful. I don't know if you have, and this is concurrent, and you have to have noticed this in people. There is an enormous, and you were talking about sunspots, and I believe we're in a new sign, we're in a new house as of not too long ago, but there is an incredible rise in the consciousness level globally, in my opinion and in my experience. And what people are having right now could only be called growing pains. Any of at a higher vibration, we can't hold the same junk that we were allowed to at a lower vibration. It just physically does not happen. One person said we have to widen our meridians. That's one way of putting it. Another is we have to clear our blockages. No matter what it is, the issues that we have are coming out in our health and in our life right now. I'm not sure if you've been seeing the same thing in your world.
Yeah, I also believe we're in the middle of a huge shift in consciousness, and the data shows that if you look at the big picture of what's been going on in history over the last 500 years, there are all kinds of pieces of evidence that we are in the middle of a massive shift in consciousness. And you can't see it on the news. You can't see it when you look at one day's events or even one month's or one year's events. But zoom out to the 10-year span and the 100-year span, and this is going to seem like a really obvious one, but democracy, representative democracy. Go back 500 years, it was nowhere. I mean, England had kind of a parliament, but it was pretty much controlled by the king. And so eventually, though, there were parliaments that had real abilities to make shifts and really did represent the people. So democracy rose. We, for millennia, literally millions of years, going back as far as human history does, thousands of years, we've had slaves. We've been slave owning, a slave owning species. And suddenly, around 1800, we began to rethink that value. And then by 1900, slavery was totally gone globally. So we revisioned our world, and the people who were the slaveholders, who had no incentive to give up their power, did voluntarily. And so all of these shifts happen in human consciousness, but they were taking, women getting the vote, they were taking 50 or 100 years. Now we see all kinds of things happening which indicate a global shift in consciousness really quickly. And so what I did when I was charting this global shift in consciousness was I had a lot of fun working with the editor of Spiritual Intelligence, making a list of them. And the list is on page 227 of the book. And we eventually had five or six examples, legalization of marijuana, assisted suicide. We found a few examples of really radical social change that had happened very, very, very quickly. But we began to look at the list, and it was a long list, like animal rights. I mean, animal rights were regarded as being, oh, they weren't even talked about many, many years ago. Now, suddenly, we're talking about animal rights and enacting legislation around animal rights. Domestic violence. When I was growing up as a kid, people were beating up on each other, and no one said anything. It was regarded as a private matter if the kids were being beaten or the wife was being beaten. Now, you're called Child Protective Services. I mean, there was no such thing when I was growing up. Domestic violence shelters are very, very new. The Declaration of Universal Rights by the UN, rights to clean water, clean food, those things were completely off the chart, off the radar when I was just a kid. Veterinary care. There was a young man I knew recently, and his dog needed a $30,000 operation. He did a GoFundMe and raised the money. I mean, when I was a kid, when I was his age, your dog needed an operation. You put the dog down. You euthanized the dog. I mean, all kinds of shifts are happening, and there are long, long lists of them in Spiritual Intelligence, all indicators of very, very large scale shifts in human consciousness. Are there wars? Is there global warming? Absolutely. There are all these terrible things going on. But you zoom out to the big 500-year picture, and human consciousness is changing really radically. Are there horrible dictators? Are there horrible people in power? Are they doing horrible things? Absolutely. But again, zoom out to the 500-year perspective, and these are blips on the radar screen of history. So I really encourage people to take that long view. And in the last chapter of the book, I share where I believe that's taking us, what law will look like. It'll be very, very different in 10, 20, 30 years. Incarceration has changed beyond all recognition. Prisons are full of meditation, full of self-help, full of people reading, getting university degrees, doing all kinds of things for themselves that were unthinkable just a generation ago when prison was all about punishment. Now prison has become much more about rehabilitation. So I project all these things into the future. I mean, things like electric vehicles. Norway is the leading country for electric vehicles right now, and most of the vehicles are electric. They're going all electric in the next few years. There was such intense opposition in Norway to any kind of initiative for electric vehicles in the 1990s. And there were these crazy visionaries who said, we want electric vehicles. And everyone said, it's impossible, never going to happen in Norway. And now that's the case. I look at things like deforestation, which is part of global warming. And we're all very concerned about the Amazon, and we should be. But if you look at the big picture, look at NASA satellite imagery of the amount of greenery on Earth, the green spaces on Earth. This is the whole Earth. NASA satellite scans. It shows that in the last 20 years, the amount of green mass on the Earth's surface has increased by the equivalent of one additional Amazon rainforest. So there are all these big picture things you don't see when you're reading the news, but are there. So we human beings are in this middle of this enormous shift in consciousness. The data shows that, and it's really hopeful to go there. When I despair, when I read the news, I just go read the data. And I feel much better then, and I realize we're part of this. And what can we do in our own lives to bring about this better world? We can shift our inner dictator. Who's your inner angry critic? Who's your inner hater and oppressor of parts of yourself? Find that being and work with that being. Work these things out internally. Then that starts to spread around you. By all means, go and be an activist. Be an activist, but be somebody who's coming from the heart and coming from that higher perspective. And so, yes, we are in the middle of that big shift. The data shows us that, and we need to operationalize that in ourselves internally first, and then go out and do stuff, protest, donate, give to good causes, spend your time, at least part of your time, in selfless service. And we do the inner work to resolve these conflicts in ourselves. And I am convinced that the world that my grandchildren inhabit will be a vastly better one in many, many ways than the one I inhabit. And I won't go into all the reasons because it would take, many, many hours, but it's there, all there in the last chapter of Spiritual Intelligence.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. I agree. And I actually wanted to bring up one of the ways that you give back, and that is, and this is dealing with consciousness. You do work on with veterans for PTSD, correct?
Yeah, I started an organization called the Veteran Stress Solution in 2007, and our goal was to get evidence-based energy treatments into the hands of veterans who had PTSD. And it's grown over the years. We now work with many veterans every year, and we have been able to offer free PTSD treatment to over 20,000 veterans since then. So it's been wonderful to see this grow, and it reached the point where we had enough evidence, we had enough randomized controlled trials to where we were accepted as an official therapy by the US Veterans Administration in 2017. So things have shifted, and now these wonderful treatments, acupressure-based treatments, energy treatments, are getting into the hands of people who are suffering, and they just get better. I mean, these veterans, their flashbacks go away, their nightmares go away. We're doing this work in Ukraine now. We were doing it in Palestine, can't do that for a little while until things calm down there. So all these suffering places in the world, and they get much, much better when people learn these tools and apply these tools, and we can release so much of the suffering in the world through them. So that's really a practical way of applying this in action that I personally have gotten behind.
Dawson, I think that's fantastic. I'm curious because a lot of people are like, oh, I got picked on as a kid. My parents didn't pay attention to me, and that's why I'm like this. And I understand it, but also, at the deeper level, it's like you also overcame it. You've grown through it. You can't be defined by it. But these are, some people, the events are bigger, some people are smaller. Now, our association with PTSD is this is a much higher level of intensity. So Just out of curiosity, I don't know if you have exact numbers, but what would you say what the parameters for success are, what the success rate is, and what the treatment protocol would be like? Because what I want is to shift the level of believability for people knowing that we can heal. So this is severe stuff that we're talking about. So if you could just tell me a little bit about results and process.
Well, parameters are easy to find if you go on to PubMed.gov, which is the National Library of Medicine in the US. And it's not every scientific journal, it's a small selection of top journals. But go on PubMed.gov, just look up my name, Dawson Church, and you'll find two sets of treatment guidelines for PTSD there that are consensus statements by many organizations that treat both veterans and non-veterans for PTSD. And what we're recommending, one of them is Kaiser Permanente's guidelines for that's the largest healthcare system in the US is Kaiser Permanente, and their journal published guidelines on the treat on these treatments for veterans. And we were looking at all the evidence for emotional freedom techniques or EFT, which is tapping on acupuncture points while you remember stressful events. And it turns out when people do this, their brains just calm down. When they're thinking about the bomb blast in Vietnam or the IED in Afghanistan, their emotional brain gets highly triggered. But when they tap on acupressure points while thinking about that, the emotional brain gets quiet really quickly. And I've worked with so many veterans, and we worked with people. I mean, I've worked with one young veteran who'd been haunted by flashbacks and nightmares of a particular event in Iraq where he served 4 tours of duty. And he just had terrible experiences, dead civilians, friends getting killed, body bags, bodies decomposing in the very, very hot Iraqi sun. I mean, just a nightmare scenario. And we had him process the worst of those events while he was tapping on acupressure points. And his level of triggering went way down, and it stayed way down. So we do that with veterans, do that with people who aren't veterans but have experienced terrible divorces, terrible childhoods, terrible car crashes, and other kinds of stress. And those guidelines show that in between 4 and 10 1 hour EFT sessions, those symptoms are gone in 90% of people. The flashbacks disappear, the nightmares disappear, the hypervigilance disappears, the dysfunctional associations disappear, and they normalize. Their levels of PTSD drop from above the clinical cutoff indicating a diagnosis of PTSD to way below that, to a normal level. And it only takes between 4 and 10 sessions. So we recommend people go on our website, EFT Universe. They book a session with a certified practitioner there, one who's trained in those techniques. And even if you don't have that degree of severity of traumatic stress in your background, you got stuff. So work with a practitioner, do the self-help method as well. And that combination of doing it yourself and working with a qualified person is just remarkable. In 4 to 10 sessions, we just see those things going away. In 1 out of 10 people, it doesn't work. And so in those guidelines, those clinical guidelines, we say those people are going to need intensive psychotherapy as well as the tapping. They're going to need social support. You need to bring in their friends, their network of buddies from the war, their spouses, their children, their parents, other social support. They may need drugs. They may need some kind of strong psychoactive drug. But again, that's only one person in 10, and that's last resort. So whatever ails you, whatever issue you're dealing with, you don't need to run to a drug first. You may need a drug, you may need medication, but we're a very medication-oriented society. We tend to go to medication very early on. And you may need medication, but first of all, tap, meditate, spend time in nature, get a lot of hugs. That might cure you.
Yeah. No, that's the real medicine.
That's the medicine. Love is the medicine. Divine love and human love and self-love.
That's true. It's fascinating. I was doing coaching yesterday with a woman, and I was working to bring her to unconditional love. And her experience was like she'd never experienced anything that she was aware of at that level. And the love is really, really, really important because in our society, and again, I think, but this was before the call, we have a society that's more heavily medicated than possibly any society in history. So that's not a problem with the person. The person is reflective of a problem in the psyche, in the mass psyche. What I loved that you said was there, PTSD, there's a sleep issue, they're able to sleep again. This is all about a harmonization of our parts of consciousness, and that would be what we call the subconscious, and then the conscious and the body. And the EFT is activating all three simultaneously, which is phenomenal, getting them to reharmonize. That's so deep. And the whole working as just working as a whole person, getting to the whole person, one in terms of repatterning, do you do any of that in the sessions? Because obviously there's bad habits associated with PTSD. Whenever I hear this is a trigger. So is there any degree, not to go too deep into it, but a person who was previously triggered every time they, a car door slams. So that is done. The repatterning is done in the session. When they think of a car door slamming, they re-trigger it and they're tapping and doing the exercises.
It's very interesting what in our healing and being wounded process and our recovery is additive and what is subtractive. And so you want to subtract certain things. You want to subtract the startle response. You want to subtract the triggering. You want to subtract the high level of anxiety, the reactivity, the negative emotion. That's all stuff you want to tap away and you want to let go and release all of those overlays that prevent us from feeling good and well and happy and balanced. And so that's subtractive. But you may have to do additive work as well. And acupuncture is a very good example. I get acupuncture regularly, and I go in there and I don't feel that bad when I go see the acupuncturist. I actually feel pretty good. But when I leave the acupuncturist, I
Yes.
feel fantastic. It's additive. It's really just liberating energy. It's doing something magical in my body. So there are additive things as well that I do. I seek the company of really elevated people, people of elevated vibration, and that's additive. Sometimes I'm sick or I may be struggling with something and I can't get better just by subtracting my stress. So I subtract all the stress and I still don't feel that great. I may need something like I worked with the Qigong master one time when I was sick, and the Qigong master sent qi into me. Reiki does the same thing. Jo-Ray, there are various forms of energy healing that send energy into the body, and you may need that boost, those additive things as well. And so there's subtractive stuff you need to do, and that's releasing all that stress. But meditation is going to be the ultimate additive ingredient because now you're connecting with using spiritual intelligence with that consciousness greater than yourself. And the earliest studies of what happens when you do that in the late 1990s showed that almost 100 genes change expression when you do that. That's additive. That's now, there's this grace, there's a sense of love. I mean, I sit there sometimes and Chris, I can't even absorb all the love that I feel flowing from the universe. The universe loves you and me and all of us so much. There is such infinite love out there. And when we subtract all of our obstacles to it and our stories about why we don't deserve it and all our energy flows that impede it and just sit there and receive it, you will weep with ecstasy because it is so powerful. So that's additive. You have that being injected into your life every day. And you become a much nicer person. The world around you changes, and your psyche is just radically shifted by that experience. So there are both of those elements to healing, and we need the subtractive stuff like EFT, stress reduction, time in nature, all that's subtracting the stress from our system. Then there's the additive stuff, and that's why I go and get acupuncture. I take a couple of prescriptions because I found certain things my body needs that little bit of a nudge to bring it into homeostasis. So even regular medicine, prescriptions, it's not like we're never going to need a prescription. You may need a prescription even after you've tapped and meditated and done all that stuff. So all these are forms of healing that are available to us modern human beings, and it's wonderful. This allows us to be in better shape emotionally and physically than any previous generation has ever enjoyed the luxury of being. And then you start to express your full potential.
Yes, and I had been meaning to ask you this, and I'm super glad you brought it up. Epigenetic expression. So I have my own opinions on it, and this is based on personal experience as well as, knowledge and downloads and all this other stuff. And it really, I view DNA as a library. It's memory. It's instructions on how to make proteins, amino acids, whatever. And epigenetic expression. People, we are in a society that is relatively high stress. People, and this is why what you're doing is so important. People, going back to the Alzheimer's, people literally stress destroys the brain. So when all you're doing is crosswords and you're not learning how to activate the spiritual intelligence. When we're stuck in that fight or flight, we don't heal. It's not part of that process. We activate. One of the examples I like to give is the grasshopper is a grasshopper, and some species of grasshopper, when under stress, their physiology completely changes, their behavior completely changes, and they become known what we call a locust. And if you look at them, they don't look the same. If you look at how they act, they don't act the same. And that's that library under the stress. It's going to pull those particular formulas, and that's what your cells are going to turn into. So really, who we are is so deeply determined by how we define ourselves. And yeah, you'd be absolutely. It's not self-care to be like, oh, well, I want to be at the 1000 on the vibration scale according to Hawkins, so I can operate at the ethereal and I don't need to take a physical medicine. Because if you're not there, you have to love yourself where you are and do the self-care where you are. And the self-love and the divine love. Now, we keep circling back to this, and it is probably the most important part. So a lot of what I work with people on is fear, doubt, false beliefs. We have been programmed, oh, I'm not good enough, or oh, I'm to understand what this love is. Once we start to interact with the world, knowing that it's all done out of love. And I use the example of you're walking down the road with a child, and the child tries to go into the road, and you hold the hand a little tighter, the kid, and then the kid keeps trying to go in, and you have a few stern words, and the kid starts crying, oh, you hate me, oh, this and that, the other. No, I don't want you to get hit by the car. I've been trying to guide you gently, and now I have to guide you a little more strongly. But it's all out of love. And once we're able to see that, that is such a deep, deep paradigm shift. But circling back, because epigenetics, once you view the world as not a threat, it gives an opening to the healing. So I know you've written some on epigenetics, and frankly, most people, I feel like you have a similar view to me, but although I'm sure there's differences and nuance, so I'd love to hear anything you can say
I wrote a book in 2007 called The Genie in Your Genes, and it's been updated every several years since then. And it was the first book to really claim that belief and consciousness and peak experiences change gene expression. And so my dear friend Bruce Lipton had written a book called The Biology of Belief, and so he showed, and he did the experiments in the 1980s showing that the culture in which cells are bathed in a petri dish changes the expression of the genes. So the culture is epigenetic. The surrounding chemical culture is epigenetic, produces changes in the genes. Then this was eventually shown to happen in live creatures like rats and mice just after the turn of the century. And so I then took that idea a little bit further and said, okay, not only is it the physical substance, the physical stuff, the physical molecules in which these cells are bathed, not only is that changing expression, but consciousness is changing gene expression as well. And that was my first big best-selling book, The Genie in Your Genes. And so I made that argument then, and I now there are literally thousands of studies showing that meditation is epigenetic, shifts in consciousness, time in nature is highly epigenetic, love, connection, social interaction is epigenetic. So we now know that consciousness does produce changes in genes, and it produces massive changes in genes in some of these studies. So yeah, that is something we can do for ourselves. And you literally see your body change, just like that locust is changed by stress. We are changed by stress, and people who live stressed lives, their bodies change. What happens to their posture is that they start to shrink. High cortisol, and that's the signature hormone of stress. If you have high cortisol, that is associated over time with increased skin wrinkling, increased loss of muscle mass. Your muscle mass degrades, your bone density decreases, your neurons become less active in your memory learning centers, and your memory and learning centers shrink while your amygdala and other stress structures in your brain grow. So now you're growing stuff in your brain, but you're growing the stuff you don't want to have grow, like your stress centers. So all of these things are happening. They're all epigenetic. And after a while, you see people in there, like you see some monks and nuns who are in advanced old age. One of my favorite videos is of a Tai Chi master, and is doing Tai Chi and is moving his body and is flowing and standing on one leg, doing these beautiful motions, and he's 114 years old. And you see some of these monks and nuns, some of them get brain scans. Their brains are a decade younger than their chronological ages because of these epigenetic changes produced by inner peace, harmony, by spiritual intelligence. On the opposite end of the spectrum, you find people who are thinking stressful thoughts, doing things that stress their bodies, eating poorly, not paying attention to exercise. In a recent study published only a couple of months ago, massive study, huge government, US government funded study. They looked at people with good mind-body habits and how long they lived. Compare those to people with poor mind-body habits and looked at the lifespan differential between the two. And they were thinking, well, maybe, eating junk food, thinking negative thoughts, not caring for your body, it's going to shave a couple of years off your life. When the data came in, the difference between the group taking care of themselves and not taking care of themselves, the difference in lifespan averaged 24 years.
Wow.
So your thoughts, your beliefs, your habits, your behaviors are epigenetic. They are literally robbing you or giving you not just years, decades of life, or taking it away. So if that 24 years doesn't motivate you to think happy thoughts, to think good thoughts, to meditate, to pay attention to spiritual intelligence, to treat your body well with great food, great exercise, lots of social interaction, if that 24-year differential doesn't motivate you, I don't know what will.
And it's 24 years, and it's not just 24 years, it's 24 years of better living. The
Right.
body itself, I like to view, what is it, trillion or whatever cells in the body, give or take. We can call some of them human, some of them non-human. Me and every thought that I have is, the way I put it, setting the weather
Yes.
for each of those cells. If I want them to thrive, I set the weather for being healthy. I set the weather for high vibration. I set the weather for joy. Set the weather for misery, and they're going to become sluggish. They're going to become, and the body has its own intelligence. I work with patients all the time, and it's like, your body, you haven't moved in 5 years. Your body thinks you're dead. First, you have to remind your body you're alive. But it's so like medicine, and it's unfortunate, has really, and science in general, has really diminished and tried to ignore the power of consciousness. Now, we had discussed earlier, I believe in the consciousness model of reality. I think if anyone would like to argue about the material model of reality, which is the billiard balls, that it's only physics and there's no intelligence, honestly believes that it all was a bunch of rocks that slammed together until lightning struck one and it got feet and started walking around and said, "Hey, I'm awake," is a really, and then self-organized to higher and higher levels. My proof of higher intelligence is looking at the Atlas moth that has beautifully drawn snakes on both wings. And I don't think a caterpillar knows how to draw a snake, but I digress. But this awareness, and science has removed higher intelligence, which I believe has seriously handicapped a lot of scientific development. And as we discussed, more scientists are beginning to bring themselves into that, because that is the source of creativity, is from the unknown, from the mystery, from the infinite. The rational mind, which would be the other side, that would be default mode network largely, is
Yes.
going to be able to replicate and restate, but it doesn't create. That's not its job. Creativity comes from the other side. Love comes from the other side, being able to fully connect to it. And medicine has been operating on this strictly clockwork view. But you've got the receipts. Our consciousness, our state of mind, and this is going back to the PTSD. I can guarantee you these people's health, because their subconscious is now in harmony. These people's health improves. These people's relationship, everything improves. So I love this, the work that you do, because it provides, when they start saying it's only in your mind, take it from there.
Yeah. When it's only in your mind, it proceeds into matter. That's why that earlier book of mine is called Mind to Matter, because it moves from mind to matter. And when I wrote that book, I looked at all the evidence that shows that our minds literally create much of what we think about as material reality. And I mean, obviously, our minds are, if we're stressed, are creating cortisol, so creating molecules in our bodies. But there are really cool experiments showing that mind, consciousness, human intention is literally able to create change in molecules outside of the body. And in some classic experiments, the researchers took healers, people with healing abilities, and they had them hold beakers of water in their hands and send healing intentions into them. And they found that the water molecular structure of H2O shifted dramatically and demonstrably when that water was blessed by a healer. When they used that water that was blessed to water plants, those plants grew faster, taller, and had more chlorophyll in them than control plants with ordinary water. So our thoughts are literally shifting our reality. And if you think it's all in your mind, if you think, oh, I think these negative thoughts and they're just mental constructs, they are mental constructs, but they're sending signals to your body, and they're sending those stress signals to your body, and your body's responding. They are epigenetic influences on your cells and which hormones and neurotransmitters get built and which genes get expressed. So as you take control of your, if we circle back to Alzheimer's in closing here, back to chapter two of Spiritual Intelligence, research looking at Alzheimer's patients and measuring the amount of beta amyloid and tau plaques in their brains, looked at every single influence on the buildup of those Alzheimer's proteins, which prevent neural signaling and eventually result in memory loss and cognitive decline and death. And they looked at the level at which those negative proteins build up in the brain of Alzheimer's patients over time. And they looked at what that correlates with: lifestyle, exercise, diet, social interaction, all of these things. The Alzheimer's gene, there's a gene for Alzheimer's called the APOE gene. They looked at all these factors and they looked for which ones are most influential. APOE gene was influential, lifestyle was influential. But the thing that was the most influential completely startled the researchers. The number one factor in the buildup of those Alzheimer's proteins was negative thinking. Negative thinking. And the more negative thinking people did, the more Alzheimer's built up in their brains. The whole effect scaled. The champion negative thinkers had the champion levels of beta amyloid plaques in their brains and Alzheimer's. And so your thoughts are literally building either decay and death into your body or life and renewal. So you can't afford the luxury of a negative thought. You need EFT, you need meditation, you need stress reduction, you need social contact, time and nature, all of these things to reduce your stress, fire up the enlightenment network, have those experiences. And then there's this enormous cascade of things happening in your body. And not only do molecules in your body change, but then molecules outside of you, like those water molecules, the plants around you are more likely to thrive because you're affecting them with, again, simply the content of your consciousness.
I love it. My real, well, real quick story. So my father, like I said, he passed from Alzheimer's. My father was depressed for basically his whole life. Really, really smart guy. Great sense of humor. So my brother and I both got the lovely, passed it down to us in whatever means, depression that we got to carry for a very long time. And both of us have been doing work on ourselves in our own ways for decades. And I'd say a few years ago, I had some big shifts, and I would not describe myself as depressed anymore. Just so anyone knows, yes, happiness does take effort. Don't be afraid to try. Don't be afraid to, it does take effort sometimes. Depression just sucks the life out of you. One of the turning points was a guy was like, I was doing negative self-talk, some self-effacing humor. He's like, "Is that how you want to be seen? Is that how you want to see yourself?" And he made me acutely aware of that, and that it was a choice, and that was one of, it doesn't just wake up and happen. So I'm aware of the power of consciousness, and I'm aware that I literally paint my reality in whatever aspects of consciousness. So I'm on the phone with my brother, who's still depressed, and he's like, "Well, you have this," because I'm trying to tell him to do some stuff. He's like, "Well, you have this positive outlook, and I'm realistic." And let me tell you, I don't light up that often, but he lit me up because I'm like, and that's the toxicity of it. And I tell people this, the rational mind is the only of the three intelligences we could call default, is the only one capable of lying. The body can't lie and the subconscious can't lie. And it lies to preserve its supremacy because it's a veneer, it's false. And it will, because it's smart, it will tell us the lies we need to hear. And it will keep us. There's one last thing I really want to touch on is you touched on it before. You said fear of death. I want to fully expand that to fear. Fear in general. If a tiger jumps behind us, we should run or do whatever we do. But the churning of fear, worry, is a habitual toxic behavior. It's a habit of thought. And as you go farther into the enlightenment network, there's more of that non-dual, less of that separation, more of that connection to divinity, a deeper trust in self and the world. And fear. I did mention it earlier, right? Fear stops being a primary mode of decision making, and decisions are made from wholeness, from the soul. They are made from that place of completeness and service. And so I absolutely like, again, your body of work is extremely broad and your area's expertise is beyond, but I'm so thrilled to have had the opportunity to speak with you. And Dawson, is there anything you'd like to close with? And please let everyone know how to find you, obviously your website, but this is a guy you got to check out.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. And yeah, please do pick up a copy of Spiritual Intelligence. And again, that's just at spiritualintelligencebook.com. And so it's just the name of the book, Spiritual Intelligence, and then book at the end, spiritualintelligencebook.com. And then you'll also get things like a free meditation track there, and you'll get a video on those four circuits of the Enlightenment Network and how to turn them on. And then share about the book. Please do let people know. Leave it a 5-star review on Amazon once you've read the book. Those 5-star reviews really make a difference to Amazon. Like now, Amazon pushes my other books because they've seen so they've got all got over 1,000 5-star reviews, and so that really makes a difference. So spiritualintelligencebook.com to get the book. And also, we'll offer you some additional meditations for free. Use those meditations. They're really helpful in learning to turn even the adverse experiences of your life into the fuel for growth. So that's the one place to go initially. I then say go get a practitioner, look at the online courses. We have online courses, very simple ones on insomnia, on anxiety, on depression. They're all evidence-based. And so you're getting science-based methods here. And there's a lot you can do to heal these things without resorting to drugs or extreme remedies. So you want to use simple behavioral things first. And there's a ton of that you'll find through that spiritualintelligencebook.com website. And apply these things to your life. Take my 30-day challenge of downloading that free meditation at spiritualintelligencebook.com and then using it for 30 days. And you're likely to find your life changing even in that small amount of time, because research shows your brain changes, so you'll feel better. So taking action is the thing to do. And then again, sharing the book with other people, sharing it with friends, family, sharing it on social media, sharing it. You'll get the first two chapters free when you order the book. It'll take a day or two to arrive, but then you get the first two chapters right away. And so share the book and let people know these solutions exist. There's a world of hurt out there. There are huge numbers of people, billions, who are suffering. They just don't know that first of those sources of suffering in Sanskrit, affliction, ignorance, just not knowing that these wonderful solutions exist. So make sure you share them with people actively. Let people you know who are suffering, send them a link, say, get this book, get the meditation, download this, and apply it in your life. You never know when you doing that is going to make someone's life dramatically better. Your single text or your single social media post might be the turning point for one person or maybe a whole group of people. So take action to bring these things to the world and then notice what happens in your life after that 30 days and email me, write me about it. I'd love to know. So, Chris, thanks so much for having me. It's been a joy to be here.
Thank you. And I'm actually going to do the 30 days myself, and I am going
Okay.
to, because I have a practice, but not really a discipline like I'd like. So I'm going to make the commitment. I will journal it. I will make it available. And I know the meditation is super awesome. And I first chapter of the book, amazing. Apply it. Don't just recommend the book. I strongly recommend that you share it when you've read it, but implement it. Let people see the changes in you. Let your changes will be the greatest vehicle to helping people to be like, now I got the book, I'm going to open it. Because that's the biggest obstacle for me. I get a book and I'm like, okay, but now I got to open it. When am I ready to commit to this book? But when they see what changes happen in your life, when you get it, read it, do it, practice it. And it's better than watching a rerun of Seinfeld for 25 minutes. I love Seinfeld. Because it's
Yeah,
only you.
definitely apply it. And each chapter ends with what are called extended play resources and deepening practices. So there are links to free meditations there. There are links to free videos there. There are ways to apply it at the end of each chapter. And I guarantee if you read the very first page, it's about a man called Anthony Ray Hinton, who was imprisoned wrongly, unjustly for 30 years. And you just start with page one, and it's unlikely you'll put the book down.
Yes. Awesome. Well, I look forward to getting my copy. And I'm so grateful again. So have a lovely day, Dawson, and thank you for coming on.
It's been a joy. Thanks again.
Thank you.